We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. I think it's fair to say that before August of 2008, most Americans had never heard of Sarah Palin. But that certainly all changed when John McCain chose the first-term governor from Alaska to be his running mate. This morning, we'll be talking with a reporter who covered the Palin campaign and is one of the authors of a newly published book. It's just out now. The title of the book is Sarah from Alaska, The Sudden Rise and Brutal Education of a New Conservative Superstar. Public Affairs Book is the publisher. And our guest for the program is Shoshana Walsh. She was a reporter and producer at the Fox News Channel from August 2001 until the end of the 2008 presidential campaign. Her co-author and partner in this project, Scott Conroy, he worked as campaign reporter and currently works as a digital journalist for CBS News. The two of them were embedded reporters who covered Mitt Romney's presidential campaign and then went on to cover Sarah Palin's vice presidential run for their respective networks. Sarah Walsh lives in New York. She's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to keep their comments brief and make it possible for us to get in as many callers as we can and keep moving along. But, of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. The toll-free line, which is good anywhere that you can hear us, is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you should feel free to pick up the telephone and join the conversation. Ms. Walsh, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
And also, I want to mention Scott was going to be with us, too. And then at the last minute, he got called away, had to go off on assignment. So next time you talk to him, you can tell him that you didn't need him. You
could, but definitely thanks so much for having us on.
Well, we appreciate it. And certainly, one cannot deny the fact that, people love her, people hate her, but she's someone who is really hard to ignore. And of all of the figures in American politics today, she may be one of the most controversial, but in a lot of ways, I think she's also one of the most charismatic. And you can see that in the way that people will line up to see her whenever she's making a public appearance.
Absolutely. She's both those things. I mean, she's an incredibly polarizing figure. And what's interesting about Sarah Palin is, you know, as you said, whether you love her or you hate her, people still want to know everything about her, and they want to read every story about her. And you know, hopefully that's why people will be interested in our book, whether they are a fan of Sarah Palin or not.
And what you've tried to do here is, and I'm sure that what most people are interested in, the big focus is what happened during the campaign, and you have that here, but also what you did, you and Scott went and spent some time in Alaska talking with people there who knew her, talking with people in politics. You had the opportunity to meet and talk with her parents, Sarah Palin's parents, to try to get maybe a little bit more complete picture of who she is and why she wanted to get involved in politics. And I think here early on in the book, you say that for someone like the two of you, anyone who has been around her, who has watched her, the question that sooner or later always gets mm-hmm. asked is, what is Sarah Palin really like?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure maybe by the end of this conversation, people will get some sort of idea. But if I ask that as an upfront sort of question, well, what is Sarah Palin really like?
Well, you know, she was, if we were in a room together and she walked into the room, she's just so charismatic and so personable and really quite friendly. So she comes across in a one-on-one meeting as just a person that you really want to talk to. I mean, she's so charismatic. But what we go through in Sarah from Alaska is that she's a lot more complicated than that. One aspect to her personality is that she really demands loyalty from people around her, but you know they don't always get that back. And you know that's something that we really learned a lot about going up to Alaska, as you mentioned, and speaking to some of the people that she used to work with. Also, you see that with her book and how she in Going Rogue, how she describes some of the people that she used to work with. You know, her legislative director really gets, former legislative director really gets, is really described quite cruelly in Going Rogue. But she plays, he's quite a character in our book, too, a man named John Bitney. And, I mean, he was the man credited in Alaska for creating who Sarah Palin is, for winning the gubernatorial campaign. And he's not even mentioned during that part of her book. So, you know, going out to Alaska was definitely, I think, probably the most interesting part of our reporting.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that really comes across with what you've written about her is that in a curious way, if you ask her fans, what are the people who have been charmed by her, if you ask them, what are the things that you like about her? And you know, you sort of make that list. And then you go to those people who they just are driven mad by her, you know, mm-hmm. you've driven crazy by her, and say, what are the things that really irk you about her? And you make that list. That it, if you look at those two lists, that probably most of the things on both lists are true.
Yeah. I mean, when you go and you talk to them, you see these people that have, some of them wait overnight to meet her on the book tour. What you hear is the same thing over and over again. I love her because she's just like me. She's real. She's a mom. You know, she has 5 kids just like me, and you hear this from people online, and they feel that because she is an every woman, that's why they love her, and that to the people that don't like her, that really frustrates them.
So before the two of you, before you and Scott went to Alaska as a way of working on this book, the two of you, you'd never been to Alaska before, had you?
Well, we'd both been to Alaska on the campaign.
Oh, right.
We went up with her once when she had a big like welcome home rally in Fairbanks, and then she spoke before her son Track went to Iraq. There was a big ceremony on September 11th before his troop went to Iraq, and then she went up to a vote on election day, and we had this kind of whirlwind trip where we went to I think we made 5 battleground state stops on the day before election day, and then flew overnight for her to vote in Alaska. So we'd been there those 2 times before we went up.
Okay. And then in the process of doing the book, you spent some more time there. I guess the question I'm going for is that you say that you think that if you visit Alaska, kind of get some sense of what Alaska is all about, what the Alaskan people are all about, you can see how it is that shaped her character. How she is a true daughter of Alaska. How did that work? I mean, what about the spirit of the state and its people do you think you can see in Sarah Palin?
That's an interesting question. And, you know, we really enjoyed our time up there, but it's true. You know, she often talked about in the trail and still talks about how Alaska is a microcosm of the United States. Well, we really didn't find that there. I mean, the place that she grew up in, Wasilla, everybody there but most people, the majority of people there are a lot like her. You know, it's conservative, mostly white people. And growing up in this homogenous atmosphere really did affect the person that she is.
And I think you also, I know that you got a chance, for example, to spend time talking with her parents.
Yes.
Who you say are actually really, were really very nice to you, or nice folks and all, but that they were really not particularly much into politics. So certainly they're a very non-political family. So then the question is, well, why is it that she decided that she wanted to get involved in politics?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we were invited to the home by to the Heath home by Chuck and Sally Heath, and they were very warm to us. And I think one of our favorite lines from the book is we asked Chuck Heath, he's a very funny, personal guy, and we asked him what his reaction was when she first decided to run for mayor, when, as you said, the family really wasn't a political one. And he said, well, I'm sure I wasn't doing cartwheels or anything. And it's just, it was really funny, but also very kind of perfectly descriptive to who the kind of person that Chuck Heath is. And they were surprised, but you know, she started with noble reasons to want to get into city government. I mean, there's no precedent set that being the mayor of tiny Wasilla would lead to being, you know, on the Republican ticket for vice president. So she won because she thought that she could make a difference, and you know, that she wanted this property tax so they could build the one of her great achievements was building this a sports complex there, and she got that done. I mean, she wanted to make an impact on her hometown. There was no clue then that you know, of what could be ahead. But you see, even in her campaign for mayor, that she did bring in some of these social issues. You know, before she ran for mayor, I mean, issues in the city really were about paved roads and whether they or not they would have a police force, which was a huge issue when she was running for mayor. But she brought in social issues, issues that hadn't been talked about before in the mayoral race, was like abortion, and she was a Christian candidate. It was something that she talked about often during her mayoral race. So she did bring in issues that hadn't been discussed before on that local level.
Our guest, let me just quickly introduce again, our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Shoshana Walsh. She was a reporter and producer at the Fox News Channel from August 2001 until the end of the 2008 presidential campaign, and was an embedded reporter first in the Mitt Romney presidential campaign and then covered Sarah Palin's vice presidential run. She and Scott Conroy, who's now working as a digital journalist for CBS News, the two of them together have written a book titled Sarah from Alaska, The Sudden Rise and Brutal Education of a New Conservative Superstar, and it's published by Public Affairs. It takes a look at Sarah Palin, her roots in Alaska, her involvement in politics before John McCain picked her to be the running mate, and then a lot of the book, probably more than half of the book, is about the campaign. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Just one other thing in about Alaska politics that I think is kind of interesting, and I don't know that people would really know this unless they'd looked at it or read your book, is that it seems that in Alaska, people tend to form coalitions around particular issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not unheard of for Republicans and Democrats to come together if there's something that they both want to get done. And that she, in fact, had a pretty good history of working with Democrats in her state. And interestingly enough, apparently she was really surprised when the Democrats in Alaska didn't support her vice presidential run. She thought that they would be willing to stand with her and put aside partisanship because they were all Alaskans. And she apparently was really surprised that didn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds extraordinary even when you're saying it, but it's true. You know, she this is something that we didn't really know when we covered the campaign, and we didn't find out until after that she really worked mostly with Democrats. You know, the Republicans, if you can believe it, thought that she was fiscally liberal because, as you remember, she raised those taxes on the oil companies, and so she really worked with Democrats. And when she was chosen by John McCain's campaign, she told them that she thought she could get Democrats in the state legislature to back her, to show that she was more bipartisan when she was governor of the state. Now, that did not happen, and it just got the relationship deteriorated more when she used some of the more hyper-partisan talk on the campaign trail. And when she came back, you know, she has said that she thought that she would come back to everybody to the same situation that she left, which is also quite an extraordinary mm-hmm. comment. And, you know, it wasn't like that. After the Democrats, even though she had worked closely with them, after they saw her use that palling around the terrorist line, I mean, they just didn't feel like they could work with her anymore.
And although she also wasn't particularly welcomed back by the GOP in Alaska either.
Right. And they never had a good relationship before that. I mean, she was always seen as kind of the underdog, the person bucking the party. And as I said before, they felt that she was fiscally liberal. She kind of went after the party chairman earlier in her career for ethics violations, which he was fined for. And so there was still some hard feelings left over from that. And when she came back, it was the same. I mean, yes, there are definitely a few Republicans in the state legislature, and I use that word realistically. I mean, it's only a few that really do like her and are loyal to her. But, I mean, there are very – and now she's no longer governor, but when she was governor, there were very few friends for her in Juneau.
And does that go some way, that political atmosphere, what was, you know, the facts on the ground when she came back after the campaign, does that help to explain the abrupt resignation?
Absolutely. I mean, when she resigned, truthfully, I was stunned. But then when I looked back at all of our reporting in Alaska, it was clear that she was fed up, that she came back into a situation that she thought was going to be very different, that she because she felt that she couldn't work with these legislators, she became even more closed off to the state legislature. She, this is something that she cited in her resignation speech, but the liberal bloggers and the ethics complaints really got under her skin, and it all led directly to her resignation. Now, if you, it's really quite an extraordinary change. I mean, you see, this is someone who, when she resigned as governor of Alaska, cited liberal bloggers as one of the reasons. You rewind, I mean, just such a short amount of time, and this is somebody who took on the oil companies, the youngest governor in Alaska state history, and she took on the oil companies that essentially had owned the state. And, I mean, it's really, I think our book really shows what, how a person can change. And it's also one theme of our book is the idea of celebrity and how that also really changes a person. Mm-hmm. I mean, she went from being in the lower 48, as they call it, where she's greeted every day by crowds of thousands of people, screaming fans, and then when she went out to Alaska, it was a pretty cold homecoming, and she wanted to return to that, which yeah. she has.
It's really, and I think one of the things that comes across, it's really striking that someone, she was someone who really had, when she was younger and involved in politics, before the point where she was picked by the McCain campaign to be the running mate, she did have this reputation for being able to work with people, particularly across party lines. But she also had this reputation of being tough, and who could dish it out and who could take it. And that it seemed that the experience, something about the experience, and maybe because it was bruising and it was personal, she seemed to be a little bit more, I don't know what the right word to use is, maybe just a little bit more fragile at the end of that process than she had been at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that's really striking, and you really said it perfectly, that instead of the opposite, which you find with politicians, her skin seems to be getting thinner throughout her career. And instead of getting tougher to some of these even frivolous allegations, you saw her put out these really almost ridiculous over-the-top statements to these ethics complaints, or even to her almost son-in-law, Levi Johnson, where I think most of the country, whether they love her or hate her, would agree, if you ignore these things, they would just go away. I mean, the ethics complaints, to a certain degree, she had to respond to them, but by giving so much weight to them, it just weight in the sense that she answered every single one with a statement from the governor's office, it gives them more credence instead of just ignoring it, especially some of these very frivolous complaints that she could just have ignored.
We have some callers here. Sure. Go ahead and start talking with people who are listening, and we'll start with someone here where we are in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? It's interesting because when she was selected by McCain, you're like, who? And so then you find all this stuff, and then, of course, the Democrats went after her. But I sort of think of her as I'm interested also in the fact that she did take on the oil companies because, you're right, Alaska is basically owned by them. And but the interesting thing to me is when I hear her on script, from when she's something's been written for her as when she was a candidate for vice president, she sounds okay. But when you hear her questioned by people off script, or, when you, like Maureen Dowd has written things that she has spoken off script, as you would say, she sounds incomprehensible to me. I mean, I don't quite understand what she's even saying. And wondering if she sounds sort of Bush-like. When reporters would ask Bush something, he would just ramble. Mm-hmm. It's like he didn't know what he was saying, or he wasn't sure what he was saying. And I'm wondering if you had an opportunity to talk to her, if you found that part consistent. Also, one other thing, when she quit as governor, you said earlier that it had something to do with liberal bloggers, or that was her excuse, or maybe the oil companies pressured her out, I don't know. But what do the people of Alaska think of that? I mean, she was hired by them for 4 years, and she walks away, and of course she had a really big book contract, and I don't know whether she bought a place in New York or what, or whether she was setting herself up for a run in 2012. But could you speak to that issue? Because I'm curious to what, if you did have an opportunity to talk to her about quitting, what the people of Alaska think about that. I mean, we impeached our governor, which, of course, I don't know what the courts will decide that. But I'm wondering what, you know, what they think if she just sort of left them dangling. Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. Thanks.
Well, I think it's a great question, and I don't think that there's any evidence that the oil companies pushed her out. That I don't think that happened. But Alaskans are upset. You know, I'm almost in daily contact still with sources in Alaska and people I've met in Alaska, and they feel abandoned and they are upset. And she knows it. I mean, obviously there are people that still love her out there, but there's a lot of Palin fatigue. That's something I hear almost every day. Also, that people are just, you know, they want to get on with the business of governing Alaska or of what it means to be Alaskan every day without talking about Sarah Palin every day. And so, you know, that's something Palin fatigue is saying that's really taken over Alaska. But I think that people really are upset. They feel abandoned. When it first happened, people would say to me all the time, well, as long as it's not about making money, then I'm fine. If it really is about, you know, whether it be the liberal bloggers, the ethics complaints, that's fine. So now that people see this book tour, I think that they are upset because they feel that she may be left to make money. Now, I mean, it's undeniable that she'll make a lot of money through this book and also through speaking. But I think that the people that love her still in Alaska, which is nowhere near the amount of people, what it's like in the lower 48, you know, a lot of people feel abandoned.
There seemed just to go to the caller's first point, I guess, there seemed to be a consensus, or at least a lot of Americans who, regardless of maybe what they thought of her political ideology, they thought this person is not ready to be the president of the United States. And apparently there were, you know, a lot of people were concerned that given John McCain's age, that, mm-hmm. that was not impossible, that she might actually have to step into that role. And there were people who felt that she was not ready, not that she would never be ready, but that she was not ready now. So you wonder, and that apparently there were a lot of people who felt that she just didn't either have the depth of life experience or political experience, or there were a lot of things that that she should have known, that she needed to know, that she didn't. So what was her attitude toward that kind of criticism, that she was just kind of green and that she didn't have the depth of knowledge and understanding of the world that you would really want for the president to have?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you talk to people that love her, and she has a very loyal base of support. There's not enough people, even though it seems like a lot of people, it's not enough people, as you know, to become the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. But you still speak to that very loyal base. They like her for that. They like her because they don't think that she's been tarnished by Washington. I mean, that's something that she talks about all the time, she talked about in Going Rogue that Juneau was like Washington, D.C. And they love that she hasn't been tarnished in that way. But now the people that hate her feel like she's not curious, not ready. And, I mean, it almost goes back to the first point, one of the first points that you made, that the people that love her and they hate her have the same elements on their list.
Well, what did the campaign do? The McCain campaign, what did they do to try to get her up to speed?
Well, it's interesting. We go through this, I think, quite in detail in our book, that there were different ways of prepping her. And one of the ways was these index cards. And what I thought one of the most fascinating things was what the knowledge base the McCain campaign thought that she possessed, which was, they believed, quite minimal. I mean, you saw in this card that said Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Gordon Brown, former Prime Minister of the UK, Tony Blair. I mean, which is quite extraordinary that they would think that their vice presidential pick didn't even know that. Mm-hmm. And one great scene right before she was going to do the Katie Couric interview, which we now was quite disastrous. Instead of prepping last minute, which is what her team thought they were about to do, she was obsessed with a local paper up in Alaska. And like, this goes back to what the caller was asking about. I mean, she was definitely concerned about her falling poll numbers in Alaska and her reputation there. And so I don't know if that's something that still concerns her, but it definitely did during the campaign, so much so that she wasn't studying as much as she should because she was obsessed with doing a questionnaire from the Matsu Valley Frontiersman, quite a small paper in the Matsu Valley.
In this hour, Focus 580, we're talking with Shoshana Walsh. She was a reporter and producer at the Fox News Channel from August 2001 until the end of the 2008 presidential campaign. She is the co-author, along with Scott Conroy, who's digital journalist for CBS News, of the new book, Sarah from Alaska. It's about Sarah Palin. Subtitle is The Sudden Rise and Brutal Education of a New Conservative Superstar. And it's published by Public Affairs Books. Before they got involved in, the two of them got involved in covering the Palin campaign, they also covered Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. And she's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next, we'll talk with someone up in the northern part of the state, up in Paw Paw, on our toll free line, line four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You know, I watch the Democrats just rake her over the coals, and I firmly believe, I'm one of those firm believers that she left because she got tired of the crap that people were printing about her. And that's just politics. Now, you know, I kind of stand behind her in a way. I'm not a Republican and I'm not a Democrat. So I'm kind of like in between, but I feel sorry for her because if she's an honest person, like, you know, from what I'm understanding, her family's been torn apart, you know, raked over the coals, portrayed as evil people on TV and on the news media. Everybody seems to hate her. No matter what she says, they can't please people. You know, there's a small minority of people who can't stand her. Unfortunately, they seem to have the puppet when it comes to, you know, the media's attention. Somebody like CNN, you know, for instance, Wolf Blitzer and those guys, they're just evil. They tear people apart, and they don't give a rat's behind about them, which is sad because that's the way the media is going nowadays. But, I was wondering, is she even considering running for a public office again? And if she doesn't, I applaud her because I think, to be honest with it, they'll corrupt her eventually. And I'll get off. Thanks.
Right. Well, that is the big question that everybody wants to know. What is in her political future? What do you think?
I do believe that she wants to run for president in 2012. And I know that it's, to some people, quite an extraordinary statement. But I think that even if you see now with this book tour, I mean, she seems to really be laying the groundwork for a future run. And, she, you know, 30 stops, mostly battleground states. And it does seem that would be would be where she wants to go next. I mean, you have to remember that she is surrounded by people every day that ask her, want her, plead with her to run for president. And I think that there's only – Sarah Palin has always been – she connects with what's right in front of her. And you really saw this during the campaign where polling numbers were down. A lot of the McCain senior staff had almost given up. But she really believed that God would pull out another miracle because she saw every day these huge crowds that were greeting her, and she thought that they might be able to win it. But – and now with these people that she's seeing on her book tour, same thing. I mean, these people are going to be saying every day, you should run, I want you to be my president, and she's going to listen to that. Now, of course, Sarah Palin is always full of surprises, so I can't kind of jump into my crystal ball, but I do believe that's what she wants.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's also, though, worth mentioning, in as much as the caller talked about her being criticized by Democrats and being criticized by people in the media, some of her most vocal critics are some of the most prominent opinion leaders in the Republican Party. There are a lot of conservatives who say they don't think that she would make a good candidate. They don't think she would make a good president. They're not really happy with her being some kind of rising star in conservative politics. So it's not just that people on the left are critical of her. There are people within her own party who have been very critical of her.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are people you will talk to kind of the GOP establishment. They'll tell you handily, I mean, on background, that they're embarrassed by her. Absolutely. But she, throughout her career, has always bucked the establishment, bucked the party. And so this is just another, you know, she feels that the establishment GOP is not, will never back her.
Yeah.
And her supporters are like that. I mean, it's kind of like what your caller just said. He said he's neither a Republican or a Democrat. I mean, she's done nothing to move to the center to woo independence or political independence, but the people that are in line that are waiting for her, they may be Republicans, but they aren't the establishment that she is continuing to buck. I mean, you saw this in the New York 23 congressional race, mm-hmm. where with her backing the conservative candidate and her really making her leap to do that was, I mean, a lot of conservative politicians followed her, but she was really one of the first who did that and bucked the establishment candidate.
She didn't think she was
conservative enough.
It's pretty clear that the McCain campaign had no idea what they had done when they picked her, and that her popularity took off to the point where she was eclipsing the candidate, Senator McCain, they were shocked. They had no idea that was going to happen. They weren't ready for it, which then perhaps gets to the question, why did they pick her? What did they think they were getting with her?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, this is on our book. John McCain's closest advisor, a man named Mark Salter, told us that everyone thinks that they did it for the base, because the conservative base was not rallying around John McCain. And everyone thinks that they didn't. They did it because they saw her as a reformer, a maverick like John McCain, someone who had bucked the establishment party at times like John McCain, and someone that could woo women, which would be very important. And what happened with the conservative base really rallying around her in such a passionate way, I mean, they were really surprised by it, as you said.
Let's take another call here. Next, Champaign County, here where we are, line two. Hello.
Hi. I wonder if you looked into the antecedents of her work. I mean, she came out of nowhere for people in the sort of the center or whatever we call it these days. But she was sort of groomed by Crystal. I'm forgetting his first name.
Bill
Crystal.
Yeah.
There were these... she spoke before Eagle Forum. Phyllis Schlafly liked her a lot. She was a big sell on that. I think Crystal and his gang, which now it's called Foreign Policy Initiative, but it was called something else then, and of course I should remember, but I'm not sure if this is part of the research you did, the way she was groomed. They had these right-wing cruises up Alaska, and she was like the highlight of the cruise. And Crystal still goes to bat for her, whereas, you know, a lot of the quote-unquote Republican intelligentsia, you know, like David Brooks, thinks that she's an embarrassment and a joke and all that sort of stuff. And I don't know what to make of her myself. I don't know how dangerous she is. But I do see her as having this forged this very vituperative right-wing right-wing women's group through Eagle Forum and other groups, and then at the same time, the very dangerous neocons as represented by aforementioned Bill Crystal. So I don't know how you'll react to that, but I think that's part of not probably discussed much on the campaign trail, but did you look into that?
Yeah, and that's definitely in our book, Sarah from Alaska. We spoke with Bill Crystal and his colleague Fred Barnes from the Weekly Standard for the book. And, you know, I don't think it was much that they were groomed by – that she was groomed by them, but they were quite taken with her. I mean, you mentioned this cruise. So Fred Barnes and Bill Crystal, the editors of the Weekly Standard, they went on a cruise to Alaska, and they had lunch with Sarah Palin and some members of her family. And they were quite taken with her. They thought that she was a breath of fresh air. They thought that, you know, that she was that they loved that she stood up to the oil companies. And it was a short lunch, but they came home. Fred Barnes wrote a piece about her, and then Bill Crystal began his talking in public about how he thinks John McCain should pick her. And so people often cite him as the creator of Sarah Palin, which he scoffs at. But you're right in that this cruise had a big impact on them finding out about her from the first time. I mean, they knew who she was, but meeting her and really being quite taken with her.
Well, let me stomp on this idea that she was such a – I mean, went to rebel against the oil companies and in Alaska doesn't call for you to do much. I mean, because they've been so quiescent and have been so much creatures of the oil industry that I just think that I don't buy the story about how she's been was so rebellious, and maybe you'll persuade me the contrary, but I don't think so. Anyway, thanks a lot.
All right. Well, I think it's interesting to go back to this story about the cruise and whether to you know how much she had to do with orchestrating that herself, and having read about this, I almost hesitate to use the word seduction, but I kind of think that there was some element of seduction involved here when she was trying to establish this relationship and get these guys who were important voices in the conservative movement to talk her up.
Well, I'll let you use that word. I won't use it. But, well, I know exactly how it was set up. A woman in Juneau named Paulette Simpson was contacted. She ran the Republican Women's Alaska Republican Women's Group. And she was contacted by the Weekly Standard, and she was the one who set it up. But, that Sarah Palin was able to woo them during this short lunch at the governor's mansion in Juneau.
Let's take another caller here. We'll go next to Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for the show,
mm-hmm.
David. It's really interesting. I wonder if you could comment on the charge that a number of commentators both on the right and the left have made that she, I don't know if pathological liar is too strong, but that it appears that she has a consistent and pervasive problem with telling the truth.
Well, I mean, I think there's no greater evidence in her book. Her book is packed with misstatements and inaccuracies. It almost reads as historical fiction. And it's interesting, I think, to read it alongside our book, Sarah from Alaska, because we have many, many, many of the same scenes. And the scenes happen, but the conversations just didn't. And it's pretty extraordinary. I mean, the way that she describes conversations with Nicole Wallace about the Katie Couric interviews. I mean, there's just absolutely no evidence that ever happened.
Well, can you want to expand on that? Anything in particular that maybe really stands out in your mind as being some case where she's telling one story, but you were there or you had researched it, and mm-hmm. you say, well, actually, no, that's not the way that it happened. Or here, another person who was said to be involved in this says, no, that's not the way it happened.
Well, I think that a great example is a personal example, and I mean, not to involve myself, but in our book, in her book, we both describe a scene of Scott and I in Juneau and meeting up with Piper Palin in Juneau. We knew Piper because she would come back every single day on the campaign plane and joke around with the press, and so we were walking down the street in Juneau. And it was the street where the governor's mansion is on, which is not like most state capitals. It's really right there on a street, on a main street. So, and it's Juneau. It was quiet, but it's a tiny town of 30,000 people. We're walking down this hill, and we see Piper. And I say hello. I ask how school was, and I kept on walking. It's about 30 seconds long. I got an hour later, I received an irate phone call from her press secretary, who was very upset and accused us of stalking the governor, and I mean, it's just a preposterous phone call. And we decided to put it in our book because we thought it was an example of how she really kind of ran the state with an iron fist and how she led up there. Now, the same scene is in her book, and it is just totally different. I mean, she says that Piper told her that she saw journalists and that and that they were the journalists that Nicole Wallace had said that they don't like you. And, I mean, that just never happened. I didn't even know – Nicole Wallace didn't even know who I was on the campaign trail, or Scott. Neither of us. And there, throughout the book, I mean, this thing I mentioned before, that her legislative director, I mean, the way he's described and how he – I mean, it's just stunning. And she says she blames – in. One big controversy before the campaign, which was governor, is that she, during budget cuts, she went into legislature and said, there needs to be an adult in the room. And that really offended some of these legislators. And she blames that phrase on her legislative director. I mean, and that just didn't happen either. And so, and then with the campaign, and she blames everything with the Katie Couric interviews on Nicole Wallace and saying that Nicole constantly –
lobbied for her. And another great example is Nicole Wallace saying that Katie Couric had bad self-esteem. I mean, things that there is just absolutely no evidence. And Nicole Wallace has come out, and I wrote a short piece on this for the Daily Beast, but Nicole Wallace has come out and said that, you know, they had a professional relationship that would have been totally, would never have happened to have such a kind of casual conversation. So throughout the 400 pages of Going Rogue, there are a lot of examples of inaccuracies and misstatements.
Yeah. One of the things that really strikes me, is just one of the things that I think of is the story. She apparently tells the story that when she was approached to be the vice presidential candidate, that she brought all the family together and she put it to a vote. In fact, not only did she not hold this vote of the children, she didn't even tell them herself.
Yeah, that's a great example, and it's something that we pointed out right when her book came out. So she said that she did an interview with Sean Hannity right after she was picked, and she said, he asked how she told the family, and she said it was a time for coming together with a vote. And, you know, I didn't ask Track because he wouldn't be involved, but, you know, everybody was on board, all the girls were. Now, fast forward to Oprah, and Oprah asked, did you take a vote for your family? And she tells the truth. And she says, no. Hmm. And so it's almost, I mean, this is something that other people have said, but it's almost that she lives in a world without YouTube or in a pre where it was the only people who really did research were people that were very interested in the topic or journalists. But now anybody can do this. Anybody can get these clips on YouTube. And, I mean, that was a really stunning change because both were on TV. I mean, they're easily Googleable.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Shoshana Walsh. She's the co-author, along with Scott Conroy, of a newly published book about Sarah Palin. The title of the book is Sarah from Alaska, and it is published by Public Affairs. The two of them, she and Scott, covered the vice presidential campaign of Sarah Palin. Scott was working for CBS and Shoshana for Fox. And then before that, the two of them were embedded reporters covering Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. So the book is out now if you wanted to look at it. And again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's an Urbana caller to talk with line two. Hello.
Hello. Did Sarah ever back up her claim that President Obama palled around with terrorists?
Well, I mean, there's no, and this is real. This is examined during the campaign law. I mean, there was no evidence to that whatsoever. I mean, as you remember, during the campaign, she cited a New York Times article, but the problem is the New York Times article about Bill Ayers said that they really didn't have a relationship. So, I mean, there's just no evidence of that, and I'm sure your listeners know a lot about that because it's, you know, he was the center of your state, but, I mean, there's just no evidence to that.
Yeah. All right. Again, I want to thank the caller. Others are welcome. About 5-6 minutes, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I wonder, one other thing that got a lot of attention was the whole wardrobe business,
mm-hmm.
I'm still a little bit confused about what did or didn't happen with that and the clothes that were purchased for her and the family and who was involved and whose idea it was and how much responsibility she had in the whole business.
Well, you know, that was something that got a lot of press, and it was one example of where she got a lot of heat and didn't really deserve it. We spoke with the stylist exclusively for the book, for Sarah from Alaska. Now she has since spoken to the New York Times, but at the point she was the only one. Mm-hmm. And she took us into what it was like during those days. I mean, Sarah Palin was one of the only people in the room that was saying, hey, this is too expensive, so much so that the stylist, Lisa Klein, and Palin's assistant were taking off the price tag so that she wouldn't know and wouldn't complain. And so that was one situation where she got some heat that she didn't deserve.
And I think it was also that somebody in the McCain campaign, that initially the woman was hired just to buy some clothes and to sort of to do a makeover on Palin. And then apparently at the last minute, somebody in the campaign said, oh, gosh, all the family is going to be there. We need to have clothes for the family. And suddenly this woman found herself going out and then having to buy clothes for the family and buy all this stuff because she didn't really know how it was going to fit and how it was going to look. And she couldn't She didn't have the opportunity to work out any deals because it was such a last-minute thing. She actually had to go out and buy everything retail, mm-hmm. which you wouldn't ordinarily have to do. And that really, it had a lot to do with the fact that she was brought in and asked to do this on very short notice by the campaign. And these stories about Sarah Palin's going on this, you know, six-figure shopping spree actually is not, it's not the case.
Right. I mean, you explained it pretty succinctly. But yeah, I mean, Lisa Klein was asked to come in. It was Labor Day weekend, and her regular outlets where she could borrow clothes or get discounts just were not available. And she did buy everything retail at Saks Fifth Avenue in New York City, and then she traveled to Minneapolis where she was shopping at Neiman Marcus and buying these expensive clothes retail. I mean, I asked, was the budget thrown out the window once it was the entire family? And she said no, but it was clear that it was just get it done. You know, price was not going to be an issue anymore because she had to shop for so many people. And she, throughout her mission of shopping for the family, that was what was in her head, just get it done and get it done fast.
She also apparently in Going Rogue says, or maybe it was in a lot of the talking that she's done since, that she was stuck with a $50,000 legal bill associated with the vetting process for the VP selection. And apparently the campaign, from what I've read, the campaign says no, she never was billed for that. Do you have the word on that?
Yeah, there's absolutely no evidence that that's true whatsoever. I mean, everyone denies it. And, you know, before the book came out in the excerpts, that was one of the first inaccuracies and misstatements, and everyone jumped on it and researched it. But then once the book came out and you saw how many misstatements and inaccuracies there were, I mean, this is just one of many. But, yeah, there's absolutely no evidence that she was billed $50,000 whatsoever. Yeah. For vetting. I mean,
it seems pretty
clear. And there's very limited vetting, which we know now. So.
Yeah, but it seems pretty clear in what she's written and what she has said that she still feels angry about the way that she was treated by the McCain campaign. She feels that she was mistreated, that she wasn't allowed to be herself. She no doubt feels that if she had been given greater freedom to be herself, that the campaign would have been more successful. Do you think, in fact, she was badly treated by the campaign?
Well, it's interesting. And there are ways that, and we kind of really lay this out in our book, but, you know, at the beginning when she felt that she was being mishandled was dealing with the press. She felt that if she could come back and talk to the traveling press corps, which Scott and I were a part of, and connect with them as she did with the Press Alaska, that it would be good for the campaign, and she wanted to do that. When they denied that to her, that was the first time she was like, hey, you know, I'm being mishandled and maybe I should trust my own instincts. But then there are so many examples of her not following their advice where it really would have been good. I mean, you see that with Michigan or Jeremiah Wright. She really wanted to talk about Jeremiah Wright, and this John McCain had banned everyone in the campaign for bringing it up. He did not want that issue raised, and she disagreed. And Bill Kristol, talk about him again, he asked her about it. Instead of just swatting the question, she engaged him, and she said, you know what, Bill, I don't know why that topic isn't raised more. And now her book, I mean, it's almost 400 pages of just settling scores. I mean, you're right. She does really feel wronged. And instead of writing a book, as most politicians do, looking forward, talking about policy in depth, it's really about getting back at people in kind of cruel personal terms.
At least one more caller here, White Heath, line one here. Hello.
Hi. You were just talking about things that she prevaricated on. What about when she said that she had gone against the Bridge to Nowhere? That was her first outing, and everyone knew that that was not true, and she kept repeating it over and over throughout the campaign. I don't, you know, did you look into that at all? Was that did she go against the Bridge to Nowhere?
Yeah, we did. That's a great question, because when she first said it, we didn't all know. It was only Alaskans who knew. And then we learned from Alaskans, and I spoke with, we spoke with the mayor of Ketchikan, where this Bridge to Nowhere would be. I spoke with the state senator from that area. And, yeah, she did a complete reversal on the Bridge to Nowhere, and it made no sense to keep on talking about it. I mean, she backed the Bridge to Nowhere wholeheartedly when she ran for governor, and she even said, you know, we should get moving on this now while, you know, while there are
people that can help us code for, you know, Ted Stevens and the rest of the congressional delegation can get money for it. Now, when it became kind of bogged down and got the name Bridge to Nowhere and it proved to be quite an embarrassment for Alaska and kind of the shining symbol of earmark abuse led by John McCain, that's when she really did a reversal. She sent a press release out very, very early Alaska time. She didn't speak with members of the state legislature from Ketchikan and that community. It was quite a reversal. And we spoke with a McCain campaign person who added that, and he did say that I'm not talking about the speechwriter, but the person that was in charge of kind of Alaska fact checking, and he did say that it was quite embarrassing, and that they really it was a hard one to get out of.
So at the end, we only have about a minute here, but at the end, how did things end up personally between John McCain and Sarah Palin? I mean, how did they? Maybe we sort of know that she felt that she was badly treated by the campaign. Did anybody in the campaign would they have said, you know, this was a huge mistake?
Well, I mean, yeah, people will tell you on background, especially since after the campaign. I mean, people have come out and criticized her, and obviously there was all the leaking after the campaign. But when it comes to John McCain, I think that's what you're asking. I mean, mm-hmm. Obviously, I'm not able to get inside John McCain's head, but he's never said anything but, positive things about Sarah Palin and how he's proud of the campaign he ran and proud of his choice. So there's no reason to think of anything different.
Yeah, I wish we had the time for you to tell the story of what happened election night.
But it starts the book, so if everybody buys Sarah from Alaska, they'll be able to read it.
At the end, where they were so terrified she was going to get up on stage and say something after she had already been told she couldn't speak that they actually turned the lights out.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating story at the beginning of the book.
Well, there's lots of interesting stuff here, so if folks are interested in reading more about Sarah Palin, who she is, where she came from, about the campaign, the book is Sarah from Alaska. It's published by Public Affairs Books, by our guest Shoshana Walsh and also her partner Scott Conroy. Scott works as a digital journalist for CBS News. Shoshana was reporter and producer at Fox, the Fox News Channel, from August 2001 till the end of the 2008 campaign. And she's now living in New York City. Thanks very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me on.